From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The House is set to vote any moment on the Republican tax cut package. Senate Republicans are putting the final touches on their bill. Here's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Orrin Hatch, speaking this morning.
Our bill gives tax relief to individuals and families across the board, with the middle class getting the largest benefit relative to their income. We provide this relief primarily by cutting rates and expanding credits for parents and families. Our bill will also help businesses of all sizes.
Earlier this week, the Senate added a measure to their tax bill that would repeal the mandate in the Affordable Care Act that every American buy health insurance. Joining us now is Senator Ron Wyden. He's a Democrat from Oregon and ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee. Senator, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
And as a Democrat, how worried are you at this point that the Republicans are getting their act together and will be able to pass this tax cut package through the Senate?
Actually, what we've seen in the last few days is a number of Republicans expressing concern. Ron Johnson from Wisconsin's already come out against it. Bob Corker has asked questions about the deficit. Susan Collins has not been in favor of unraveling the Affordable Care Act, which this legislation does. I can go one after another, and they're all expressing some concerns. And this is not unlike what happened with health care. Nobody thought we could win. And what happened is one senator after another said this is not the way to make enormous changes. I mean, we're talking in the tax arena about tax policy changes that could involve $10 trillion. You shouldn't make those kinds of decisions on the fly. That's what the Republicans are doing, and I think it's catching up to them.
So you think if a vote were held today, they wouldn't have the votes to pass this in the Senate?
Well, I'm like Yogi Berra. I don't do predictions, especially about the future. But what we saw with health care is similar to this. One Republican after another started to express concerns. And what we're doing now is generating enormous grassroots opposition to this. The public is catching on to the fact that there's a double standard here, the tax breaks for the multinational corporations that ship jobs overseas. Those breaks are permanent. The breaks for middle-class families are temporary. I think a lot of senators, and we're going to finish in the Finance Committee, we won't get it on the Senate floor, a lot of senators are going to be going home for holidays, and if middle-class folks at the grocery store ask them about it, this is going to be a hard bill to defend.
Would you support this bill if those middle-class tax cuts that you're talking about were made permanent?
The reality is right now you can't fix this bill with tinkering. You know, I've made it clear that I'm for a strong bipartisan bill. We've said that as Senate Democrats. We've said we think the system is broken. We think that you can only fix it with a bipartisan approach because that provides certainty and predictability. And the bills that I wrote most recently with Dan Coats, a member of the Trump's cabinet, very much track the principles that the president has said he is for and that our letter describes.
Do you think that the inclusion of that provision that would get rid of the individual mandate in Obamacare, the requirement that everybody has health insurance, do you think that makes it more likely or less likely that this can pass?
I think it certainly helps us to generate opposition. And look, they have failed on Trump Care 1, 2, and 3. Now what they've done in the last couple of days is they've turned a badly flawed tax bill into an even worse bill because they have made it a health care bill. And for example, yesterday, Senator Brown, our colleague from Ohio in the Senate, started asking about, well, okay, maybe a middle-class person will get a few hundred bucks in terms of the tax portion of this bill. But then if you unravel the Affordable Care Act, what we've seen is the budget analysts show that your premiums will go up 10%. So that middle-class person will take a hit of $700, $800, $900. And then all of a sudden, they go even further behind as a result of the fact that the Senate Republicans have made this bill worse.
How do you argue against the case that Republicans are making, though, that cutting corporate taxes will make the U.S. more competitive, that jobs will grow, that wages will go up?
Well, you stick to the facts. They made a big deal about how you would cut the corporate rate to 20%, and this would raise salaries for middle-class folks $4,000. I asked the head of the Joint Committee on Taxation about that yesterday, specifically that question. He said, look at our tables, and then he basically said, no way that that's going to happen. Second, Gary Cohn, the White House economic advisor, was filmed here in the last day or so at a big meeting with corporate CEOs, and he asked them, how many of you are going to take these tax cuts and use them to create more good-paying jobs, what I call red, white, and blue jobs? Virtually no hands went up. I mean, it was a real spectacle, a big embarrassment for the administration, because we know, and we've seen this by following investor calls, that the companies are going to put this money into stock buybacks and other things that help them rather than creating more red, white, and blue jobs.
So how do you get companies to actually invest? We know that there's a record amount of cash being stored overseas or out of the country by many of the biggest companies in America.
Well, the real challenge, it seems to me, and Henry Ford said this. Henry Ford said, look, I'm an industrialist. I want to do well. But for me to do well, my people have to have enough money to buy my cars. And the consumer, the middle-class person, drives 70% of the economic activity in our country. So when middle-class folks have money to spend, whether it's on education or childcare or a house or a car, that's the economic multiplier that really drives significant economic growth. It's not trickle down. It's not giving more breaks to corporations that are already awash in cash and show up at meetings and when confronted, as Gary Cohn did about putting money into jobs, they say, nope, we're putting in breaks for stockholders.
That's Ron Wyden, the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee. Senator, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Does your car have new technology that tries to keep you in a lane when you drift? Do you have a great dashboard infotainment system? But maybe you don't know how to work that system. And maybe your car's safe driving features give you a false sense of safety. And maybe you're like the 41% of Americans who still use their smartphones to text while driving in 2017. Consumer Reports found that and other chilling statistics out in a new report today on distracted driving made worse by some of the new technology in cars. Jake Fisher is the director of automotive testing at Consumer Reports. He joins us now. Jake, give us the overarching here.
Well, really, there are so many different things that are distracting us now that we drive these vehicles. And part of it, yes, is the cell phone in our pockets and all of the internet that's available there. But the cars themselves have become more complicated. There's internet connectivity. There's apps built into the cars. And we're also seeing this trend where the vehicle controls are just getting much more complicated. I mean, older cars, they have knobs. You have the volume knob and you have your tuning knob. Now, sometimes it's a series of menus that you're going into these vehicles for just even simple tasks.
Well, one of the other things you point out is that we're moving towards autonomous cars, self-driving cars, but we're not really there yet. We have a lot of features that are supposed to help and sort of make the car smarter. But in the meantime, we're not fully there. You speak with the president and CEO of the National Safety Council saying we have this mix of autonomous, semi-autonomous, manual. And so it gives you a false sense of safety, perhaps. Talk about some of the car's safety features, and do they help?
Sure. Well, it's a mixed bag right now. And there's some safety features out there that absolutely help, and they reduce crashes. Some of those include automatic emergency braking and forward collision warning. So basically what's going to happen is, say you glance off the road or you're not paying attention for that split moment, the car will actually sense that there's a car in front of you, and it will hit the brakes for you. That's with automatic emergency braking. That absolutely makes a difference, and that could stop crashes. But the interesting thing is there is a potential for danger because there are cars out there that can steer for you, they can do speed control for you, but they're not very good. They're not going to be able to notice when something changes out there, and you still have to pay attention. And if the car is doing so much for you, it's not really clear whether or not people are going to continue to stay engaged in the driving experience.
Right. So there's a false sense of security, maybe. Well, you've got so much in this reporting. We'll link people at herenow.org. But meantime, which are the most and least distracting infotainment systems?
Sure, there's quite a bit of a range. And what's really interesting about it is that the domestic automakers, they do a much better job of this than some of the Japanese or the European makes. So some really good ones are actually from Chrysler, from General Motors, and Ford is actually doing a pretty good job with it now too. Some of the most complicated ones are actually from Lexus, Mercedes-Benz, Tesla, Volvo. These ones just have a lot of – it's not just about the features, but it's complex. It takes many steps to do even the simple things.
Is there a sense of Consumer Reports that we have to get to autonomous cars because people are more and more distracted?
Something absolutely has to change. Clearly, a full autonomous fleet could do something about that. But honestly, that's going to be years and years away. In the meantime, automakers have to make these simpler. They have to make the controls of these vehicles simple and intuitive and not require you to take your eyes off the road to use the features in the car.
Yeah. It used to be you just turn on the radio. Jake Fisher, Director of Automotive Testing at Consumer Reports, thank you.
You're welcome.
Earthlings have a new neighbor. The Journal of Astrophysics reports the discovery of an Earth-sized exoplanet orbiting a star about 11 light years away. And they say it might meet basic requirements for life. If that is true, a new Chinese telescope might be the one to make first contact. The huge radio telescope is in the karst mountains of southwestern China. It's 5 football fields wide, deep enough to hold 2 bowls of rice for every person on the planet. It's as though God has pressed a perfect round fingertip into the planet's outer crust and left behind a smooth silver print. So writes Ross Anderson, science editor for The Atlantic. He recently toured the new telescope, a facility that will scan billions of wavelengths across billions of stars looking for a beacon. Ross, beautiful writing. And a beautiful place, so remote, your driver wanted to turn around and your GPS stopped working?
It was a bit of a journey to get there. I mean, first of all, it was just quite a long haul to get to Shanghai. And then a long but pleasant and fast train ride to the southwestern countryside to a city called Guiyang, one of the more remote and poorer provinces in China. It was quite a drive from there. We had this 4-hour drive away from Guiyang, and I think after hour 2, we never had a reliable account of where we were. So it was nutty.
And then you finally find this huge bowl, as you write, large enough to hold bowls of rice for everyone in the world, surrounded by these mountains which look like snaggletooths, you know, coming up from the earth. Very, very dramatic. So let's back up. How did we get here? How do we get to the point where China might, in fact, make first contact with extraterrestrial life and has this huge facility? Because as you write, over China's history, and you take us, you know, very in depth, even though they have the oldest culture of astronomy in the world, they were often very behind in science.
So if you were to sort of pick a year at random out of the last 4,000 years out of a hat, odds are China was going to be at the sort of scientific and technical vanguard or very close to it. It is only in the past few hundred years that China has fallen behind, and now it is busily trying to even the score, I guess.
Yeah, catch up but also pass. Now the country on the pace to outspend the U.S. on R&D in this decade. And yet we should note, too, that the U.S. also kind of fell behind in this particular race, the search for aliens, about 25 years ago when it was defunded by the government. There was this sense of it was Martian hunting.
Yes. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, was defunded. And you had a couple things going on there. For one, it was the early 1990s. Newt Gingrich's Republicans had just been elected and taking control of Congress, and they were in a spending-cutting mood and sort of looking for things that were easy to beat up on. And I think after a kind of long golden age, when Carl Sagan sort of first rose to prominence, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence was sort of this romantic activity that people were really excited about. But the fact that this search might take quite a long time indeed was starting to sink in right around the time politicians were looking for easy targets for funding cuts. And so SETI was defunded at the government level. And to their great credit, Jill Tarter and some people at the SETI Institute in Northern California really tried to soldier along with generous gifts from donors. But it was never the same. And China is sort of coming into its own scientifically, unencumbered by that cultural baggage, at a time when we have discovered all of these planets around neighboring stars, when all of a sudden SETI is starting to look like quite a good idea again. And so being able to start from scratch, they're like, hey, you know, we're going to build a big radio dish. Of course it's going to be interested in SETI.
SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And yet you talk about how there's a lot of cross-pollination between countries. Now, today, you've got the Russian billionaire Yuri Milner pouring hundreds of millions of his own money into the SETI program at UC Berkeley. And then you've got UC Berkeley's Andrew Simeon helping the Chinese build this dish. What do they do with it?
One interesting thing, and this gets back to the tension in this piece where China is sort of running ahead in science but also still trying to catch up, there's no one in the Chinese scientific firmament that can manage an observatory of this size and complexity because there's never been one there.
Hmm.
And so they're currently looking for a director for the telescope from abroad. And so, yes, they're involved in several international partnerships, including with Andrew Simeon's Berkeley group.
Well, and you have one of the best science fiction writers, well, some would say in the world, but definitely in China right now. Who is Lu, and why was he at the dish?
He, you know, he's quite a celebrity in China, especially whenever sort of cosmic subjects are being discussed. He actually consults for the government on aerospace missions, and they're sort of eager to play upon his reputation for being quite a broad thinker, someone like an Arthur C. Clarke or a Carl Sagan here in the United States.
Yeah.
I thought it would be really interesting to talk to him about some of the kind of deeper philosophical questions around what it would be like to open up a dialogue with an alien civilization.
And by the way, Barack Obama, as you write, told the New York Times that Lu Xixin's books gave him cosmic perspective during his presidency. Lu told you his Obama staff asked him for an advance copy of the third volume. So he's widely read around the world. What does he say about potential first contact?
He seems to regard it as quite a dangerous thing. You know, he has a character spouting this dark forest theory, which basically says that no civilization should announce its presence to the cosmos, because if there are aliens waiting out there, they're probably going to be looking to eliminate any threats to their future, and any other civilization would be regarded as such a threat.
The thinking is that anyone we would make contact with would be older and maybe wiser. And Lu says, you know, he's given this a lot of thought, would have hidden themselves.
Yeah, that's correct. So SETI researchers, I think, take it for granted that anyone we made contact with would be more advanced than us, for the simple reason that we've only just stumbled on radio technology. So if you have some distribution of civilizations in the galaxy, the odds that they would be as young, so to speak, as us would be quite slim. And I make the argument in the piece that to survive on cosmic timescales, whether that's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, potentially even millions of years, that maybe that would lead you towards some more peaceful behaviors. Maybe you would learn to be tolerant and not, you know, rush to invade or eliminate any civilization that you might encounter. But
yeah,
maybe not.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. You dive deep into what might possibly be out there. It might be a post-biological artificial intelligence that had taken control of its planet. So it might have transformed its entire planet into a supercomputer. And according, these are Oxford researchers you're quoting now, it might just have shut itself down to sleep hundreds of millions of years until, you know, the time is right to come out. You write, you know, these are radio waves. Radio waves are the weakest form of electromagnetic radiation. The collective energy of all the radio waves caught by Earth's observatories in a year is less than the kinetic energy released when a single snowflake comes softly to rest on bare soil. A beautiful sentence, but really? Is it going to be that hard?
Yeah, they are radio waves are quite ethereal. They are soft whispers that sort of fly across the universe, and all kinds of astronomical phenomena give them off. So black holes give them off in great magnitude, and you know, stars even give them off. But teasing out the ones that might be from an intelligence could prove quite difficult.
Yeah. Well, you tease apart all sorts of theories about why we haven't found a single civilization, despite having searched 100,000 galaxies. But here are these people investing billions of dollars in this. Does anybody say, well, maybe there's just nothing out there?
Sure. I think that responsible scientists will always have the null hypothesis in mind. However, it's certainly the truth that we've looked at only a fraction of the sky, at only a small fraction of the frequencies. So I would say it's premature to conclude now that there is no one out there, but it's definitely a live option. I find it quite persuasive that, you know, in each galaxy, of which there are more than 100 billion in the observable universe alone, there are hundreds of billions of stars. And in just the last 5 years, we've had this really a new kind of scientific revolution where we've discovered that nearly every star that we look at in our galaxy has planets around it. So that's a whole lot of laboratories where life may have evolved. And, of course, there are many, many steps between evolving, say, a single-celled organism and something as complicated as a human being that can point a dish up at the night sky. But I'm hopeful, I guess.
What was it like to be there?
It was incredible. As I say in the piece, the thing that really took my breath away first was the mountains. And in the foreground, you just have this massive, you know, kind of brand new sparkling silver dish. It was gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine you didn't think, you know, do it now. Come now. Let's hear from you.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I'd like to be like Jodie Foster, you know, with the headphones on.
Right. That's Ross Anderson, science editor at The Atlantic. He recently turned the brand new alien-seeking facility in China. We'll link you to his writing at hereandnow.org. Ross, thank you so much.
Robin, thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
What now for the country's largest consumer watchdog? Richard Cordray said yesterday that he would step down as director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau by the end of the month. The bureau was formed in 2011 after the financial crisis as part of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act. And joining us now is NPR's Chris Arnold, who covers consumer protection issues. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Jeremy.
And there is some speculation that Cordray is leaving because he wants to run for governor of Ohio. Many Republicans would like to do away with the CFPB altogether. So now with his departure, is the very existence of the agency in doubt?
Well, it's probably too dramatic at this point to speculate about, well, are they going to completely dismantle this agency, the Republicans? But look, I mean, certainly for years now, many Republicans have attacked Cordray and the CFPB, but now they control this agency. So and it's also very popular across the political spectrum. There's one poll out that showed that a majority of Trump voters want the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, left alone. So, you know, would Republicans, now that they control the bureau, expend the political capital to tear it apart? We'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Well, what has Cordray done as director of the CFPB? What's his accomplishment?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. Democrats hail him as a hero of consumer protection. And under his leadership, the bureau went after mortgage lenders and big banks and payday loans. And it took action against a big company that it said was cheating people who had student loans. altogether it put $12 billion back into the pockets of everyday American consumers. And because of all that, Wall Street watchdogs and consumer groups say, hey, look, Cordray was doing a great job, and they're sad to see him go.
And what is it that the Republicans don't like about him?
The main thing was two things, right? One is they felt like he personally was too aggressive and too much like a man on a mission. But also they had a problem with the basic design of the CFPB that some claimed was unconstitutional, that there was just too much power in a single director. And also, you know, that the Trump administration came in on a very deregulation-oriented mission, and Trump put business-friendly people in charge of, say, the EPA and other agencies. And so Cordray was a holdout. And it would have been very tough politically and even legally for the president to try to fire him. So all that just infuriated Republicans.
And even with Cordray in power there at the CFPB, Republicans just managed to undo a rule from the CFPB that would have allowed consumers to bring class action lawsuits against financial institutions.
That's right. And this was one of Cordray's signature accomplishments at the Consumer Bureau. It took 3 years to make this rule. And basically what it was about is when you get a credit card or you open a bank account, there's like some fine print in the three-page agreement that you sign that says, I promise not to sue the bank. And the CFPB said, well, look, I mean, you can't do that. People need their day in court. But Republicans in Congress disagreed and they overturned the rule.
So now it's up to President Trump to nominate a successor. What might happen?
Well, you know, who knows who's going to be put there, but consumer advocates are worried that a lot of ongoing work could be delayed. They might try to, Republicans might try to weaken the Bureau structurally in various ways, or, you know, put someone in there who has their feet up on their desk and, you know, isn't really being an aggressive regulator, or in some other way just try to defang this powerful watchdog Consumer Bureau.
It's NPR's Chris Arnold. Chris, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
A report, Tough to Hear, and released today by Human Rights Watch, concludes that Myanmar's military systematically raped women and girls as part of a campaign of ethnic cleansing against the country's Muslim minority Rohingya people. Myanmar was supposed to be the story of a Buddhist-dominated country moving on from authoritarian military rule under the new leadership of Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. Instead, it's a story of how the military whipped Buddhists into a nationalist fervor. Buddhist farmers attacked their Muslim Rohingya neighbors with machetes, some Rohingyas attacked back, and the military roared in a ruthless rampage. Yesterday, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was in neighboring Bangladesh, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have fled.
The recent serious allegations of abuses in Rakhine State demand a credible and impartial investigation, and those who commit human rights abuses or violations must be held accountable.
The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse just got back from the border between Bangladesh and Myanmar, where he found cell phone video that seems to be further evidence of atrocities committed against the Rohingya. And a warning, this is very difficult to hear about. And Gabriel, we could see it was very difficult to report. Talk about what you found on the border.
Well, it's not so much the conditions on the border, Robin. I mean, people are living in camps on sort of the muddy slopes of hills in tarpaulin and bamboo tents. But it's the stories that they have to tell, which are not just allegations. They corroborate themselves. We focused on just one massacre that took place on the 30th of August in one village, Tulatoli. We spoke to six witnesses there, which added to testimony collected by Human Rights Watch, by Amnesty International, by other journalists, and indeed by other investigators. Their stories fit with each other. There are very few discrepancies. I think we can without doubt say that what they tell us is true. And what they tell us just in this one particular case is that the army came into their village on the 30th of August at about 8 in the morning. They rounded up all the men, women and children, shot many of the men and the children, separated out the women, made those who were still alive dig pits in which to bury the dead, bludgeoned people who were half dead to death with the rifle butts and bamboo sticks, and then herded the younger women into huts, mostly five at a time, where they raped and then in most cases killed them. We spoke to a few of the survivors. And the thing about this is that their stories fit, that they all click. People who've been interviewed in different locations, this is undoubtedly true. There's no question about this.
Well, you met with, for instance, Mohammed Suleiman, who lost his wife and three of his four children that day. In this image that we see as he speaks to you, he's holding one last child and crying. Let's listen. He's saying, my child cries for her mother. How can I bring her back? This is heartbreaking. And also, as you say, they corroborate many of these stories. It's nauseating to see the cell phone footage that the Rohingya took. But these people, you know, have cell phones and they have stories to tell. What did you see?
Everyone has cell phones these days, Robin. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's getting harder and harder for these kinds of atrocities to be committed without their being recorded. That doesn't mean that the perpetrators don't get away with it, because they do seem to be getting away with it at the moment, but without being recorded. So we were shown cell phone footage of the massacre at Tulu Toli. What we saw was after pictures of the river where all these people had been herded and rounded up, and then we heard gunshots going on. We then see three young children being washed up on the other side of the river. This is footage taken by some of the villagers who fled. They've swum across the river to safety, and they're watching the bodies of these kids wash up on the riverbank. Now, often when we get this kind of cell phone footage, we have to add a caveat. We have to say we can't confirm the veracity, the authenticity of this cell phone footage. In this case, that's not the case. I spoke to the woman who was the neighbor of these kids. We showed her this footage. She said, yes, those are the children of my neighbors. I know their names. This is Rashida. She's 5 years old. This is Kushida. She's 3 years old. This is the son. He's 11 months old. They came from a family of 12. They were all killed. I showed the same footage to another person who wasn't from Tulu Toli but who'd been there on numerous occasions, who confirmed to me, yes, this is the riverbank at Tulu Toli. So we can't say this isn't confirmed. We can say this is confirmed. This definitely happened.
Well, it's appalling. And in the same cell phone footage, they are, you know, listening to the gunshots on the other side of the river they just swam across. Let's listen. And it's just horrific. And then, you know, these little bodies wash up and they try to pull them out of the water. And they are, well, you know, I mean, again, this is very difficult. There's a child whose brains are blown out.
Yes. And the thing about this story is, I mean, I've been reporting on conflict for about a decade now. I've reported most recently on the atrocities of Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. And I can tell you, I've never covered anything more horrifying and shocking than this story. This is violence that is committed against the population, the Rohingya in Myanmar, who in any case are denied some of the most basic rights that people should expect in their lives. They're denied citizenship. They're denied the right to vote. They're denied the right to travel freely in their own country. They're denied decent education, decent health care. And it's violence that is committed against these people by a government that is led by somebody who has been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. This should shock the whole world.
Look, the Burmese military says their military campaign against the Rohingya is in response to an attack carried out on August 25th by an insurgent group called the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army. But you spoke with a Bangladeshi border guard who told you that the Burmese military was there long before that August 25th attack. And you report villagers had signed an agreement, a kind of armistice, between the Buddhists and the Muslims. Tell us more about this and what's behind this conflict.
So what the villagers of Tulu Toli told us is that a couple of weeks before the massacre, the local Buddhist village official, the village administrator, who's the representative of the government there on the ground, called everyone in and demanded that, A, they stop supporting, as he put it, the militants, these Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army members, and B, made everyone sign a sort of peace treaty in which the Rohingya Muslims undertook not to attack the Buddhist villagers, and the Buddhist villagers undertook likewise not to attack the Rohingya Muslims. And what the Rohingya villagers told me is that they took that document to be a sort of guarantee of their safety. So in the days before the massacre. They'd seen other villages be burnt in the nearby area, be burnt by the military. But they'd been given this assurance by the local Buddhist official, don't worry, stay in your homes, you'll be safe, I guarantee it. Now, they felt double-crossed by this. They feel like this was a deliberate ruse to get them to stay in their homes so that they could then be killed. Now, I'm not sure that we can say that with 100% certainty. Certainly, this low-level civilian official wouldn't have had the power to stop the very powerful Burmese military, who are still very, very powerful, even under the new democracy run by Aung San Suu Kyi. But clearly, there was preparation for violence taking place in the border region weeks before those militant Rohingya militant attacks took place. There are people who say, look, this militant group, it's real. There is an Islamist Rohingya militant group that is fighting the Burmese military there on the ground. But they're not very strong, they don't have much capability, and that the Burmese government is exaggerating their strength in order to use it as a pretext for whole-scale ethnic cleansing of civilians. And that certainly did appear to be corroborated by what some of these villagers told us.
I am taking with me, you know, the woman who showed where there's a scar where someone tried to slash her throat. Another woman telling you that her infant was taken from her arms and thrown to the ground and killed.
Thrown into a fire and burnt to death.
The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse in London, just back from his reporting trip to the border between Bangladesh and Myanmar. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya people have fled horrific violence there. We'll post a link to his work at herenow.org. Gabriel, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. Thanks for having me on.
Thanksgiving is a week away, a day when many Americans will be avoiding uncomfortable conversations at the dinner table, especially if guests fall on opposite sides of the political spectrum. But a year-round event called Make America Dinner Again aims to tackle that fear of an awkward meal. Bianca Taylor from member station KQED in San Francisco explains.
It's 6 p.m. and the guests are arriving at a San Francisco loft. A young Bolivian woman, a former Marine, a UC Berkeley grad student whose family voted for President Trump, a conservative lawyer, and a transgender adoptee. They've never met each other until now. Once the pizza is delivered, the facilitator, Haley Stewart, ushers the guests to a table and lays down some ground rules.
Really try not to make judgment statements. Don't say, you're bad, you're wrong, you're crazy. Try and put those into I statements. So this made me feel.
Justine Lee co-founded Make America Dinner Again a day after the 2016 presidential election. She says she wanted to put her energy into something productive to heal what she saw as a huge national divide. Dinner felt right.
People can look around and just recognize how special it is to step outside their bubble and outside of their daily work grind and just come together.
All of tonight's dinner guests have applied online to be here. They seem excited to do the work of bridging their differences. In the first exercise, they are paired up and asked to find one thing they have in common. I listen in on Walt Shefflow and Min Madsen's conversation.
You grew up in South Dakota, right? I'm from North Dakota.
Midwest.
Not only the Midwest, the Dakotas.
But other than that, these men are very different. Min is a transgender male, liberal, and was adopted from Korea as a child. A few years ago, he adopted a son of his own. Walt, he's a white conservative who voted for President Trump. He's a father of four and is a lawyer.
We're going to give each of you guys 10 minutes, and you're going
to... Stuart's next two questions to the pairs are, what has shaped your identity and what has shaken it? Walt starts. He says he's been upset by how hostile the Bay Area got after the presidential election.
It was very disappointing to me to hear the things that were said to me in particular and to my friends. Meanest things I can possibly imagine.
Then Walt asks Min, what about his identity has been shaken?
As a person of color, we see the most recent demonstrations of clear signs of very divisive racism, as you talked about. There's a lot of things in the media that talk about the target of trans people, including the military.
But then there's a connection.
Is your identity, do you, if somebody says, so what are you? Or some, I'm not thinking the right words, I'm sure. Would you say transgender first?
I would say I'm a father first.
You're a father. There you go, man. There you go.
I'm a father first. Yeah. And then I'm a Korean adopted transgender man.
Okay. All right. I say way to go because that's how I would identify too.
It seems like Walton Min could have talked about fatherhood all night. But Haley Stewart interrupts the group to lead them into something she calls radical empathy. She tells them that when they regroup, each person will share their partner's story, but in the first person. The idea is that if you can listen and then share someone else's story as your own, you can internalize it and create a deeper empathy.
Do we have any brave volunteers to go first?
I am Min Matson. I was adopted in Seoul, South Korea. I grew up as a young woman and then transgendered. And I'm a father. I have a son who is 4 years old. Transgender seemed to be targets. Since I am transgender, I think that is a difficult thing to do. I am proudest of being a father and a son.
Then it's Min's turn to tell Walt's story in the first person.
Many of my family members are small business owners, and a lot of them work in agriculture. So I learned a lot from them and what that looked like, and I always really respected the work that they do. And people talk about the South as being really racist, but I really think that the Bay Area is very racist.
After the dinner, I pull each of them aside to ask them what they learned about themselves and their partners. First, Min.
I very much appreciate him. I think he is a very, very good-hearted person who has felt hurt and has felt left out in some spaces.
Min and I definitely disagree politically on issues, but the thing I like about him is he's facing life's challenges in a positive way. And one thing I really liked, he told me tonight, the two most significant things in his life was the first time he heard his adopted parents call him son, and he heard his little boy call him father. And I can identify with that.
In just a few hours, a white, conservative Trump voter and a transgender Korean adoptee broke bread, shared their stories, and came away with something that seems to be lacking these days. Respect. For Here and Now, I'm Bianca Taylor.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.